7 session of the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee. And I will open a public hearing first on House Bill 2726. I'd like to call forward, please, Representatives Shields and Buckley. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43, here to testify in support of House Bill 2726, of which Representative Buckley and I are chief co-sponsors. Mr. Chair, over the next 10 years, this body will be involved in supporting research that I think is very important to our state. Research that will benefit manufacturing in Oregon. An example of this is Manufacturing 21 Coalition, which I wholeheartedly support. And when I was at a Portland Development Commission meeting hearing about the Manufacturing 21 Coalition, one of my constituents, or a company that's in my district, the Human Resources Manager for Small Parts Manufacturing, got up and said, you know, this is all very good and I think will be helpful to my company, but shouldn't we make sure that it's explicitly stated somewhere that the purpose of this research is to create jobs here in Oregon, as opposed to, say, improving manufacturing processes in China? And that really is what this bill does. And I thought about that for a while. And so I talked to Legislative Council, and the result is House Bill 2726. And House Bill 2726 simply says that if we are going to invest in research that will benefit private enterprise, the agencies involved in contracting for that research shall ensure that one of the purposes of the research is to keep or create jobs in Oregon. And I would anticipate that this kind of language would be placed into RFPs and or contracts, really just as a reminder to all staff involved in these projects that this is the legislative intent to create jobs in Oregon. This bill will also help assure our constituents that we all stand for creating jobs here and would not support in any way using taxpayer dollars to hasten the outsourcing of jobs to other countries. It's a pretty simple bill, Mr. Chair. As often happens when you put a public hearing on the agenda, it gives a chance for other people to come in and present some ideas that you perhaps hadn't thought about, and I just found out that OUS thought that there might be some unforeseen consequences to this bill. They'll talk more about their concerns, and I'm happy to sit down and talk with them and delay the work session on this bill today. I think that one of their concerns will be that that there might be instances where we're doing good research that doesn't have a whole lot to do with job creation, perhaps in environmental concerns and other things. And I think there may be some merit to that. But I think one approach I might present to them is on line 8 of the bill. If we could say something along the lines of the research, if it primarily benefits private enterprise, then one of the purposes of it would be to create jobs here in Oregon. But I'm more than happy to work out with OUS and other people who might have concerns about the bill to see if we can come up with a compromise.
Thank you very much, Representative Shields. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Peter Buckley, State Representative, House District 5. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today. I join with Representative Shields in support of House Bill 2726. I have a longtime friend I run with every Saturday slowly while I fill him in on what happens in Salem. And every now and then I tell him about a different policy that we're pursuing, and he stops running and stares at me and goes, "You mean we don't do that already?" And this is one of the cases where when I tell him about this tomorrow morning, he'll say, "That isn't our policy already." This is the kind of framework that should be in place for our state-funded research dollars. And I agree with Representative Shields that if the language needs to be adjusted, but I also do want to make clear again that it's a very simple policy. And on lines 8 and 9, since it ensures that one of the purposes of the research. So we're not trying to limit the purpose of the research. We're just trying to make sure that the creation or retention of Oregon jobs is one of the purposes that we have. And just for the record, I would like to note that this bill does have the support of Representatives Barker, Barnhart, Beyer, Bonini, Boquist, Dallum, Dingfelder, C. Edwards, D. Edwards, Escobal, Flores, Galizio, Garrard, Gelser, Girard, Greenlick, Holvey, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Crummell, Lim, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, G. Smith, P. Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Witt, Senders, Monroe, Brzezinski, and Whitsett. Thank you very much.
And the cast of thousands.
And the cast of thousands.
Thank you both very, very much. Questions or comments for our representatives? Yes, Representative Dahl.
I've heard both of my colleagues say that we need some rework on the bill. I guess procedurally I'd ask you, Mr. Chair, are we going to ask them to bring back an amendment to us after they work with us?
Yes, we are.
Thank you.
And Vice Chair Lynn.
Yes, Representative Shields. What was the concern that the others expressed on this bill?
I think primarily that there might be some unforeseen consequences of putting this into the statute, but they'll testify to their concerns shortly.
Okay, thank you. And just for consideration, I'm going to ask if you can do a little work group with folks and work out a consensus on this. But it was also suggested to me late last night on line 8, where it says shall ensure. Possibly, just for your consideration in the work group, to the extent practicable or something along those lines might add a little security.
Mr. Chair, given the danger of discussing these bills late at night, we'll still take that into consideration.
With that, I want to thank you both so very, very much. Welcome to our committee. Feel free to drop by any time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, I feel there's some danger in discussing some of these bills at any time.
I'd like to now call up Lisa Zalala and Bruce Schaefer, please.
For the record, I'm Lisa Zavala, the Senior Associate Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. I have with me today Mr. Bruce Schaefer, who is the Director of Industry Affairs for the Oregon University System. And I've asked Mark Nelson of the Public Affairs Council to join us, if that was all right with you, Mr. Chair. I will defer to him to talk a little bit more about a partnership that we have with the Oregon Metals Initiative. And Mr. Nelson represents the Oregon Metals Initiative. Mr. Chair, although we believe that the intentions of the bill are honorable and we understand them, and we do fear, though, as Representative Shields has mentioned, that there might be some negative and unintended consequences for Oregon and for the students that we serve. Particularly, we're concerned about the bill's impact on overall research. That and our mission of overall research for the Oregon University System and our campuses. That mission is to educate our students and to expand our knowledge. Historically, our campuses have relied on federal agencies as their primary source of funding for research. Nevertheless, we seek to increase our collaboration with industry for two reasons: to increase and diversify our sources of funding, and to more directly tie university research to Oregon's economy. Some of the research will directly enhance jobs in Oregon, but other research will have other desirable benefits, like reducing environmental impact, improving public safety, as well as educating our students. and I might want to add that it concurrently actually happens. As we do this research, we are educating our students because they participate in that research. An example might put some of these issues in context. As I mentioned, the OUS Industry Affairs Department, which Mr. Schaefer directs, administers a research matching fund called Oregon Metals Initiative, whereby companies work with faculty to develop research projects that are funded 50% by the company and 50% by the general fund. Administration of the program is very simple. We assume that the companies perform due diligence and thereby assure that not only the most beneficial projects are funded. I'm going to go ahead and just skip down for the interest of time and let Mr. Schaefer and Mr. Nelson reference the OMI. I will skip down to the bottom and say that most of our campuses, Mr. Chair, involve students and projects in the community with companies as well as governmental and non-governmental organizations. Much of this work relates to the learning experience of the students, but also may involve some research or some benefits to the companies. There are literally thousands of these arrangements each year because of the work-related requirements of such programs, such as Portland State University's University Studies Capstones Project. This is a project required of every graduating senior at Portland State University. Accrediting associations now encourage undergraduate research as part of determining learning, and many of our campuses use local businesses as real-life laboratories for that research. We are concerned that this bill could unintentionally make it more difficult to maintain and grow such opportunities for our students. Thank you for letting us present our concerns, and we do welcome the opportunity to work with Representative Shields and the other sponsors of the bill to work out our concerns.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Schaefer, Director of Industry Affairs for the Chancellor's Office. I joined the university system as a member of industry who was interested in advancing the cause of education, and one of the missions of my department is to better connect our many academic departments with industry. Over the 9 years that I've worked with the Chancellor's Office, I've discovered we have a lot of great researchers who do what you would do if you had their job. They try to figure out how to bring federal dollars to their campus and to Oregon. Inevitably, doing so tends to align what they do with federal agenda, which most of us would probably agree with at the federal level, but sometimes it's quite different from what we as Oregonians need for our students and for our industries. So one of the missions of my department is to try to provide ways for those faculty to better work with industry so that more of those federal dollars can be beneficial to Oregon. As part of preparing for testimony today, I talked to people on a variety of campuses, both over the phone and by email, and I've come to discover that as we look at university research, we can think of it at least when we focus on state-funded research, it falls into three general categories. Funds that the university receives in collaboration with other state agencies. Nice thing about being a public university is as we figuratively sit across the hall from other state agencies which have important public missions, and we can provide research capability to them that not only benefits their missions but benefits our students by allowing those students to participate in that. Examples, of course, would include public safety, public transportation, public health, reducing environmental impact, many other goals that we would applaud. If I were to make a list of all the goals I could think of, I would expect keeping and creating jobs would be at the top. But I'm not sure that I would be able to come up with a complete list of things that we would, as Oregonians agree, would be beneficial to Oregon. To look at it a different way, I think we have two sorts of puzzles. One is, when we're done listing the criteria, how do we administer it across seven campuses that have hundreds of grants that they're administering, some that come from state agencies, and some are internal. I mentioned the one with other state agencies. There's also research that we do to enhance our education mission. About 7 years ago, my department was looking at the possibility of helping other departments add distance education to make education more convenient for working adults. But we realized that just offering it wasn't going to be necessarily a good thing, because we might offer the right or wrong mix. So we ask our campuses and a couple of private research entities, what would it cost to survey our student audience to better understand how to serve them? And the most cost-effective work was a private company, and they brought us the results of what's called conjoint analysis. It gave us much better insight into how to serve our own educational mission. I think a tiny little project like that, not too controversial, except it wasn't about jobs. It didn't even occur to us to think about how to create jobs out of this little project. We were focused on our educational mission. Another category is collaboration with industry. I alluded to that earlier, and you'll hear some more about the Oregon Metals Initiative. Lisa's already mentioned it. By collaborating with industry, we can take our researchers and connect them with industry so that they become more cognitive of how to serve Oregon's needs and benefit our students so that they're more work ready when they graduate and go out into industry and contribute and help Oregon's economy grow. So in summary, we'd like to work with the proponents of this bill to solve the two puzzles. How to administer it efficiently so that we're not incurring additional costs to the taxpayer that are unnecessary, and how to deal with the multiplicity of worthy goals of public-sponsored research, and how to best serve our students along the way, since that's our primary mission. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much. Mark.
Mr. Chairman, members of committee, my name is Mark Nelson, and representing the Oregon Metals Initiative. The OMI, as we term it, is a consortium of metals industry companies and research institutions in the state that are working on the long-term competitiveness of the industry. We have 55,000 jobs in the metals industry in the state, representing about 1,700 companies. Back in 1990, we started OMI, and it was established as a mechanism to both support and enhance the competitiveness position of and contribution of the metals industry in Oregon. The organization is managed by a 10-member board, and the objectives are to develop new technologies and new applications of existing technologies, increase metals research capacity, accessibility, and infrastructure, encourage collaboration on research between the metals industry and Oregon scientific research institutions, and improve the competitive position of Oregon metals industry. We meet that those objectives through an industry academic research projects. Interested companies approach interested institutions, particularly Oregon State University and Portland State, to develop project proposals. On or about July 1, our 10-member board meets, looks at those competitive proposals, and make a determination as to which ones will be funded. They're funded on a one-to-one basis. In other words, 50% by the institution and 50% by the industry participant. Again, there's no administrative dollars. All the money goes to research, and the actual companies pay for the administration separate and distinct from the actual research. Currently, we are matching $500,000 to $500,000 each year. It is deemed nationally to be one of the most successive private public projects in the country because of its streamlined administration and because the money all goes into the research. We too are only concerned here with unintended consequences that might come as a result of this. Every project we do, we hope help keep and enhance job opportunities in the state of Oregon. We think they all do. I'll have to say that once in a while, though, we'll do a research project and it just falls flat. It doesn't come up with the outcome that we wanted to happen, as that does happen in research. Our other concern, and we also represent Association of Oregon Faculties, I would just mention Ag Experiment, Ag Extension, College of Forestry, who also are very involved in research with private industry. They may or may not have concerns about unintended consequences here as well, but I think we can work those out with the proponents of the bill, and we'd be happy to do so.
Thank you very, very much, both for your testimony and for that offer. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Actually, reading through the bill, if you go to line 8, it says the agency shall ensure that one of the purposes of the research is to keep and create jobs in Oregon. If we change the word to ensure to encourage, it seems to me like that probably would alleviate a lot of the concerns. And that's just maybe a suggestion. Is that kind of what you're looking for, sort of? Or
I would say that's the general idea for the RFP that goes out to get the proposals that Mr. Nelson talked about. Well, we should confer, but offhand, that would probably work well. I have a bit of a fear of the unknown in that I don't work directly on these campuses,
okay,
and
sure.
some of the projects that they receive may come to them from an agency to say, well, we need to figure out how to make our bridges from falling down. Can you help us on this? And exactly how we encourage them to create jobs out of that worthy research.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could do it, but there might be some chasing of tails, so to speak, of trying to adopt or change a good idea into something that also fits the criteria.
Okay.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, if I might, I just wanted to point out that we did submit, for your reading pleasure, testimony from Mr. Gary Chaffins from the University of Oregon, Director of the Office of Research Services and Administration. You brought that along.
And we have his testimony. Thank you very, very much. And Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious if, you know, I've listened to this a little bit, and, you know, it looks like a few of us have signed on to this bill, but I'm just sort of curious if you can give me an example of a research project that's been done in our university system that has benefited a private enterprise that has not kept or created a job in Oregon or didn't result in that. And I guess I'm asking for an example of a research project that this bill would have eliminated that you've worked on with a particular private industry.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I personally probably could not give you an example right now at this moment. But that drills right down to our concerns. We want to be able to work with proponents and do some brainstorming, think about how some of those research projects that on the surface may not appear to be encouraging or ensuring that they create or maintain jobs in the state of Oregon, that actually as the research is done and the product is implemented or perfected, that in fact we do see jobs created. So that's what I'm asking for, to work with the sponsors of the bill to look at those in more depth. I'll defer to Mr. Schaefer if he does actually have some research, because he actually might.
Again, it's mostly the fear of the unknown, as given the large variety of research that's done. That small example I gave of my department needing to survey our professional students about their interest in distance education. It was not a goal of that project to create or retain jobs. It was a goal to do a better job of educating people that were already in the job force. And I suppose we could say, okay, well, if they're better educated, then maybe they'll keep their jobs. But again, that's not where we were coming from. It was a different part of our mission that we were thinking of on that day. We asked over the last week our campuses to tell us of projects that are state-funded, and they asked their database, and we have a list. But I don't claim to understand the list, but when I see an item that says seismic vulnerability, it sounds like a project that probably is important to Oregon. Whether it creates or retains jobs, I don't know, but it might improve public safety. So that's the complexity of the matter.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
But I guess what I'm missing there is you know, that project didn't benefit a specific private enterprise. So I don't think this bill affects that, because you're not benefiting a specific business, basically. And I think that was sort of the intent of this bill. And so in your description of that fear of the unknown, and in relationship to what you've described, I don't hear a specific business that was working with, that was benefiting from that grant, I guess.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holvey, again, I'm not sure of any one case, but some of the projects on this list were probably primarily research done by faculty, but they might have engaged private enterprise. So to that extent, private enterprise may have benefited simply by doing part of the work. Others of this might have benefited private enterprise because the result of the research was to go and add additional brackets to a bridge so that it could be serviceable for another 50 years. And so, again, exactly how we think about benefiting private enterprise. You start with the basic principle of the bill, I agree completely, but how you administer it and understand when we're benefiting, when it, we're probably going to benefit, and when we're going to be creating and maintaining jobs, it seems like we have to have a lot of Solomons on every review committee to figure these things out. I don't think it's that hard, but again, I'm worried that it might be.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add, maybe to answer the question a little bit in reverse from the metals industry point of view, if you when you have time, you might go through the projects that we have here, and some of them are very technical and detailed. But I would submit that every one of these projects, one way or another, enhances or helps to keep jobs, either by making the metals industries more competitive, by coming up with different products, different alloys that can be used. And I think you'll see the breadth of that if you looked at these. Our primary concern is we are very streamlined. We don't want to go through a long, laborious process of trying to really determine if this is 10 jobs, one job, are we retaining jobs. I think we're very comfortable in attesting that every one of these projects are really aimed directly at what your bill does. So.
Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes Representative Hovey and I change nameplates just to confuse you people on the dais. I think I'm going to clear this up a little bit. I signed on to this bill. I have a partner that I have coffee with every morning. He was a professor at Oregon State for a long time. And when I ask him if he wants cream, we end up talking about what's in cream, its benefit to the body, what we perhaps should avoid in cream. I think what we're looking at, and I'm going to make this, is we started our conversation on Skill Up Oregon. And that meant anybody that we could elevate to a higher position to make them a more productive Oregonian, that's what we wanted to do. And I don't think I see anybody shaking their head. So now comes two of our colleagues with a bill that says, if there's research and it has the potential to skill up one Oregonian, we want that research to benefit Oregon as much as we can. I think we've made a fairly simple concept. Whenever there's an advantage that might be had for Oregonians, we want to take it. And that's the simplicity and the purity of this bill. And I'm sure my colleagues will carry my message to you. We're not interested in who straps the bolt to the bridge. But if it can be an Oregonian, it should be an Oregonian. And I think that's where we are.
Thank you very much, Representative Dahlem. Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Chair Wick. I just want to express my thought on this bill. In case if we change, the agency shall ensure, if we change to shall or encourage it, then we have some problem with the relating clause. The relating clause said that they require certain state agency. This is some kind of a mandatory, but when we are changing encourage, then that doesn't match in a technical sense. So I just want to alert the possible problems of this bill.
We'll ask, thank you, Vice Chair Lim. We'll ask our work group to whatever language that they're considering, that they also consider the relating clause at the same time. Thank you for that point. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm just sort of following up on the drumbeat here and saying, when I signed on to this bill, which I did, I read it, and to me it says, if you're going to benefit private industry, make sure it's Oregon. And I think that's where I want to be. And I want you to be careful in amending this that you don't take that out. I certainly want you to do all sorts of research projects. That's what universities are about, especially research universities like Oregon State and Portland State. And certainly one of the jobs, and the main job, is to teach the students, to give them an opportunity to learn doing research. But when there is private enterprise that is enhanced by this, we want it to be Oregon. And that's really all this is about.
And with that, I would like to take you up on your offer to work with the primary sponsors of the bill and to work out something that everyone feels comfortable with. Thank you. Thank you again for your offer. Thank you so much for your testimony, and it will be an even better bill when you're done. Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify today on House Bill 2726? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on that bill. Commissioner Gardner, trying to determine how we're going to proceed here. Are you on a schedule this morning?
Not at all this morning, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
I guess I have enough to do. Vice Chairman, I think I'm going to do the
question. Okay. Next, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution Number 15. And I'd like to invite Representative Lynn to be our first witness.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and for the record, my name is John Lynn, state representative from the District 50, which is Gresham area. And I'm very happy to be here to explain and the House Joint Resolution 15. And I just want to say that currently our state enjoying one of the best the trade volume in the nation in comparison of our population. Our state is a trade state. We trade worldwide, but we especially trade with Asian country. But more than 80% of our total volume goes to Asian Pacific Rim country, which is very important. Trade begins with a goodwill. It doesn't just happen overnight. We need to build a relationship. Especially in the Asian mind, relationship begins the trade. And so when we are thinking relationship, I thought maybe if the governor would appoint a goodwill trade ambassador to each major trading partner, might create a goodwill. And the governor, he doesn't have to appoint, but only encouraging the governor to do that. And this HJR 15 doesn't require any money. And maybe governor might be able to pay some of the expenses, travel, some basic things, but he doesn't have to.
only bills encourages to appoint the trade ambassador to each country. It could be the ambassador from our state, or it could be ambassador of the country, someone that the ex-minister of the trade or foreign affairs, and they are retired, we might be able to appoint a person in the country to encourage more trade of a respected country of ours. So this bill, 1999, is passed in the Senate, but the House failed to act on it. And I'm doing exactly the same thing again, and I'm hoping that without costing any tax dollars, we might be able to promote more trade. Trade is getting bigger and bigger. As you know already, we are exporting about $12 billion a year, including Canada and mostly Asian country. We shouldn't limit our trade with Asian country alone. It could be expanded throughout worldwide. And the world is getting smaller and faster, and we need to take the opportunity, the presence of Oregon in the worldwide. I'm hoping this HJR 15 is a good resolution, advancing the course of our state, and we all should be a salesman for our state. And so with that, and I didn't ask any state agencies to come to testify in behalf of this SJR 15, but I'm open to any questions if you have.
Thank you very much, Representative Lemon, and a very good salesman you are, too.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you. Representative Lim, the $64,000 question is, who's going to pay for the travel of these ambassadors if the governor elects one of these people to be an ambassador, say, to Korea or wherever? Are they expected to pay their own traveling expenses? If not, then there's an expense to the bill. So.
Well, if governor think someone from our state and wants to join maybe a governor's trade mission to Asia, and usually they pay their own expenses out of their own pocket. But the governor believes the person is worthwhile to pay for some of their traveling expenses. It's strictly up to the governor. And the governor doesn't have to pay a dime. But anyone who wants to be a trade ambassador, the person should be a person that is financially successful. And he should be a person that the, in terms of money-wise, that the must be reasonably fairly that the rich person, but he or she might be enjoying just a title that the trade ambassador for the state of Oregon. That title carries a lot without costing any tax dollars. Please, strictly up to the governor, whichever the governor wants to do.
Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lim, do we not already have a trade commission inside the Department of Economic Development?
We do have an International Trade Commission. I believe it is about 11 members. I'm not quite sure. So Ron Reagan is the chair, and also we have Economic Development the Commissions.
So do they already, I'm just curious, do they already do some of this work as part of that commission? Aren't they sort of working with the governor as our ambassadors through that agency already? Or am I missing the point here?
Thank you very much, Chair Witt and Representative Harvey. That's a very valid question. And mostly what they are doing, they are advising to the governor. And sometimes they could join the governor's trade mission, but they are going as a commission, as a trade ambassador. I think that name, that the trade ambassador is very enticing. This is the good name. And then this name will carry a lot and says the volume. In case if I go to Korea, I'm not asking the governor to appoint me, but in case if he would appoint me or anyone else, I can say I'm the trade ambassador for the state of Oregon, and that will carry a lot and give a position of the person to negotiate to advance. But it doesn't have to be the person living in our state. Maybe such as in Japan, in Korea, or China, anyone that retired from the high government officials, we can appoint a person, and you become the trade ambassador for the state of Oregon. The person will carry a lot, and working with the trade office in each respected country.
Thank you. Representative Lim, I came to better understand the importance of that personal relationship in trade through the two bills that you brought earlier on South Korea, and I don't think I ever had quite the feel of how important the personal relationship is to Asian trade. But I agree with you. I better understand it now, and I want to thank you very much for your continued efforts at international relations and extending Oregon's economy throughout the Pacific Rim.
Thank you very much for your comment. And then if I just add one more thing, that Korea was used to be a third and fourth trading partner, and until the last month or so, Korea was the number one trading partner in volumes over Japan. And in the overall trade, Canada is number one, but Canada is our country joined together in land. But China is now taking over number two position. Korea is number three. Japan is number four. So we have ample opportunity in the future to make our trade volume higher and higher if we have a right person. Things happen that drew the person. The person's position is very important to advance the trade. That's why I'm introducing HJR 15. This is a good thing without costing any tax dollars. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much, Representative Lim. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on this resolution? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution number 15, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2831. Ellen, would you please give us a summary of the bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2831 makes legislative findings about the negative effects of outsourcing of jobs overseas. It responds to concerns about job outsourcing by prohibiting the state from awarding a contract for development assistance to vendors, bidders, contractors, subcontractors, or applicants for development assistance that perform the work at a site outside of the United States. It also requires the state to terminate the contract, seek penalties, and prohibit the recipient from receiving any further contracts with the state for 5 years if the recipient transfers the contracted services overseas.
And I'd like to first call up Arthur Stamoulis.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Arthur Stamoulis. I live in Hillsborough, but today I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, a statewide nonprofit organization that's based in Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to voice our support for House Bill 2831. International outsourcing of jobs, also known as offshoring, is a major problem in this state and across the nation. The U.S. trade deficit in goods and services increased to $763.6 billion last year. The impact of this massive trade imbalance on U.S. job loss is very significant, and some have quipped that American jobs are fast becoming one of the nation's leading exports. The sector of the economy that has experienced the most to date has been the manufacturing sector. Approximately one out of every six American manufacturing jobs, 3 million manufacturing jobs in total, have already been lost due to offshoring. And the auto production industry is indicative of this. Once a mainstay of the U.S. manufacturing sector, according to the most recent Census Bureau data, the U.S. now imports 68% more automobiles, trucks, and parts from Mexico than we export to the entire world combined. And certainly this is a trend that will not be helped when Freightliner's Portland truck plant reduces its workforce from 1,700 to 900 later this month, a step it is taking while simultaneously expanding its truck manufacturing operations in Mexico. The state's forest product industries and its agricultural sector have both been hit very hard by offshoring and increased foreign imports, with hundreds of jobs lost in Bend, Coos Bay, Salem, Klamath Falls, Nissa, Hermiston, and elsewhere, often in parts of the states where, even with increased opportunities for education and job retraining, adequate replacement jobs are simply unavailable. And the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign estimates that 68,000 Oregonians have already lost jobs due to offshoring and foreign competition since the mid-90s. And so while the manufacturing sector has certainly been hit the hardest by this offshoring, you're increasingly seeing service sector and high-tech jobs shipped abroad. The United States imported $341.6 billion in services in 2006. This includes everything from IT support to engineering to financial services. The financial research firm MoodysEconomy.com estimates that 160,000 private service jobs have already been offshore since 2001, and this is a trend that is projected to increase greatly. The Progressive Policy Institute, a pro-free trade think tank, estimates that 12 million U.S. information-based jobs are highly vulnerable to offshoring. These are jobs that currently pay higher than the median income in this country. So these are good quality jobs. If you add other service sector jobs to the mix, the number of U.S. jobs that could be offshored soars from anywhere from 28 to 42 million, according to Alan Blinder, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve. And so the potential for service jobs to be offshored makes the 3 million manufacturing jobs that have already been shipped abroad look like a drop in the bucket. As devastating as the job loss that has already occurred in Oregon has been to individual families and communities, the widespread offshoring of service sector jobs would be much, much worse. And it's important to note that the offshoring of U.S. jobs has a ripple effect that reaches far beyond just those individuals whose jobs are lost. Local tax bases are reduced, threatening state and local governments' abilities to provide public services unless, tax revenues are increased elsewhere. When trade deficits increase and jobs are lost, there's also a documented stagnation in wages across sectors. The average U.S. worker has received only a 5 cent per hour raise in real dollars since 1973, despite a near doubling of worker productivity over the same time period. And so, while our organization has not specifically studied which, if any, services procured by state agencies have already been outsourced overseas, we believe that if preventative measures are not taken, a large number of services procured by the state could very easily be performed abroad. In particular, this includes most forms of data entry, computer technical support, bookkeeping, paralegal support. Most services nowadays are very vulnerable to outsourcing. And HB 2831 helps counter this problem. It's a simple and worthy measure, a first step towards addressing Oregon and the nation's growing problem of trade-related job loss. And clearly on its own, it can't solve all of the country's offshoring problems, but we think it can make significant headway in the following four areas. First, HB 2831 would prevent Oregon taxpayers from subsidizing the cost of offshoring. Outsourcing work abroad can be resource-intensive, particularly if it requires the development of new work protocols, the development of new infrastructure in terms of facilities abroad, communications infrastructure. And HB 2831 would prevent Oregon taxpayers from footing the bill for those startup costs, associated with offshoring. Secondly, the bill will ensure that services procured by the state are performed in a manner that is at least somewhat consistent with local values. Firms often offshore work abroad in order to take advantage of lax labor and environmental standards. By preventing offshoring, HB 2831 ensures that employers providing services for the state at least meet a certain minimum standard regarding child and forced labor, hours and wages, workplace safety, and environmental sustainability. Thirdly, HB 2831 maintains job opportunities for American workers by ensuring that services purchased with state taxpayer money provide the added value of providing job opportunities in this country. And finally, HB 2831 sends a message that the state legislature considers job creation a priority. Many Americans are frustrated by the job loss caused by offshoring. This is evidenced in part by the 37 freshman members of Congress who were elected on fair trade anti-offshoring platforms this past November. HB 2831 sends a clear message that Oregon legislators care about American workers and hopefully can serve as a model for other states and for the nation. And because of these clear benefits, the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign urges members of the committee and the entire legislature to support this bill. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stamoulis. Questions or comments from our committee? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain what your plans are for others testifying, but I have a legal question about the issue, and I don't know whether this is the right witness to ask or not. But let me ask, and you can tell me if you have an answer. I know that the World Trade legal difficulties are significant because of the United States treaty obligations under a variety of treaties, including NAFTA and others. What is the legal status vis-a-vis American treaties of a bill like this?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is a good question. I am probably not the best witness to answer it completely. I can say that other states have passed similar legislation. It's certainly true that there is a form of what I would call international preemption, and that's something that the Oregon legislature will have the opportunity to consider in other memorials this session. But I would encourage the state to move forward with this bill. There is a process that has to take place before a state's law can be preempted and challenged, and ultimately under the World Trade Organization, for instance, it's really the responsibility of the federal government to make sure that obligations under the WTO get met. So I wouldn't be afraid to push that envelope.
Thank you. And follow up, if I may.
Yes, please. Yes,
thank you. I attended a meeting, multi-state meeting. The organization's name, everyone knows it, is escaping me at the moment, in which former Representative Krupp and I were the two Oregonians there. It's interesting because he and I disagree about almost everything in the legislature, but we agreed completely about the mess that the United States has gotten involved into in the preemption of state law by the U.S. trade negotiator. That's really the issue that I'm trying to raise. I'm very worried about it because, of course, under the Constitution, the states have a certain set of responsibilities, but the treaty clause in the federal Constitution makes treaties the law of the land, and of course may preempt state rights, as it were. So it's interesting that this is not a partisan political issue at all at the state legislative level, and I suspect that state legislators from Maine to Southern California and from Florida to Washington or to Alaska would agree about that issue. I appreciate the fact that you're suggesting we push the envelope. I agree with that completely.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chairman. To follow up on Representative Barnhart a little bit, I'm kind of reading through the bill, and I particularly have problems on page 2, lines 8 through 18, and it's a little bit of the enforcement mechanism. And my question to you is, let's give you an example. OHSU, they have a contractor who's erecting a building. The electrical switches are made in China. The steel's made in China. Does that throw him under this bill into a penalty phase where he can't get any state contracts for 5 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe not, that the bill deals primarily with services, not goods. And so the outsourcing of services would be prevented. But certainly the state purchases many goods that, from computers to pens, you name it, that are produced abroad. We live in a global marketplace, and that's certainly the case. But in terms of vendors hired by the state outsourcing services abroad, that's what this bill seeks to address.
Well, if you go up to lines 2 through 4 on the same page, it says, or applicant for development assistance that performs the work at a site outside the United States. So, work services, I'm having a little bit of difficulty because, obviously it takes work to create steel. It creates work. Like Representative Barnhart, I'm pretty sympathetic, especially given my party affiliation, for this issue. And I'm not opposed to the bill as a whole. I just think the language, LC has really come up with some stuff here this last year that I just have problems with a lot of the language on page 2, and I think it probably needs to be cleaned up.
And that may well be the case, Representative Gerard. Thank you. Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you. Chair Witt, outsourcing is a big concern. We all share that. But what happened, the people coming from illegally here, and working in the farms and many other areas, and that's it. It covers in this House Bill 2831. What is your interpretation on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I do not believe that this bill covers that. There are certainly other laws that are supposed to cover that problem.
Thank you. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question was similar to Representative Gerard's. I support the intent of this bill. I just want to make sure we don't get into a lot of legal problems, as Representative Barnhart suggested. But I think as a public agency, and this is probably not a question, or as a state, we can choose to do business with who we want, just like anybody else in the world, without being called into the World Trade Organization's idea that we're violating any treaties as far as trade goes. But I guess that remains to be seen. If we prevent a city, perhaps, from doing trade, we might get into a little bit of an interesting discussion. But clearly, I think if the state decided that we didn't want to outsource, we could probably make that decision and not be in violation of our federal treaties. But that remains to be seen, perhaps.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I just want to say I don't think this has anything to do with party. You said, given your party affiliation, I think that's a bad statement. But at any rate, the one thing I wanted to ask, and I agree with a lot of things that are said here, I believe we should be pushing the envelope. The way things get changed that we don't like is by pushing the envelope. And But there's one thing that I'd like you to maybe try to clear up for some people who might be listening, and maybe myself a little bit as well. Would you explain the difference to us, in very briefly, the difference between free trade and fair trade?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I can start by identifying what fair trade is. Fair trade is trade that meets certain labor standards, certain environmental standards, certain human rights standards that generally there is a consensus on in this country and, quite frankly, in most parts of the world. Our organization believes that increasing trade is a good thing, that globalization has been going on for many, many, many years, that it's inevitable, that there can be many, many benefits from it. But today's free trade agreements deal with far more than just tariffs and quotas. They affect many, many, many aspects of public policy regarding public procurement, subsidization and regulation of services, the environment, land use, you name it. And our organization believes that trade policy should be used as a vehicle for improving living standards in the U.S. and throughout the world, that there should be certain basic agreed upon labor standards, respect for existing environmental treaties, respect for basic human rights tenets included in trade policy, and that trade agreements through the WTO, through NAFTA, through other free trade agreements should not prevent state and municipal governments from being able to enact policies on a wide range of issues, including procurement, which we're discussing today.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Additional questions or comments? Mr. Stamoulis, I first want to compliment you on a very well-documented piece of testimony here. And I also want to say that I agree with your assessment that there may need to be a pushing of the envelope. When we have allowed our federal government to enter into international trade agreements that do not provide any protections against child labor or basic protections for workers in terms of their safety and health, workers' compensation, overtime, or any environmental protections, then I think we may be very well placed in terms of pushing the envelope. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate your comments today, I'd like to call up next Commissioner Dan Gardner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And, Mr. Chair, you couldn't be more right that the last speaker just about covered everything one could humanly possibly say about this issue. You know, I'm an absolute firm believer in fair trade versus free trade and deeply concerned about the tens of millions of jobs, especially in manufacturing, lost around this country over the last decade to two decades. What we're talking about here, though, is certainly when taxpayer dollars are spent. And I think the best example certainly is one in recent history of the Oregon Trail Card, where we ended up subcontracting with a firm from India for a service that could have been well done right here in the state of Oregon, most certainly within the United States. And as we seem to chase the cheapest labor market in the world for the cheapest we can find, we are violating many tenets of fair labor standards practices, from unemployment insurance, minimum wage, overtime, child labor laws, workers' health and safety. It's deplorable. And I think when we use taxpayer dollars, we have a higher obligation to see how they're spent and to see that they're spent appropriately and to see that they're spent in a way where we're trying to promote family wage jobs with health care and retirement for people who live within the state of Oregon first and people who live in the United States second. I think that, you know, the interesting thing as you get into the free trade debate is that if you look at comparisons with other nations, the United States in its free trade agreement is one of the freest. There are other restrictions within other nations. A prime example is try to sell U.S. rice in Japan. You can't do it. It's against the law. So free trade with sideboards on it for other nations and not sideboards within our nation doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and I certainly do appreciate your patience here and waiting to testify today. Questions or comments? Thank you very much, Commissioner. I'd like to now call up, please, Elisa Zavala, Stephen Fowler, and Paul Primack, please.
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. Today I am accompanied by Mr. Stephen Fowler, who is Systems Manager for Technology Support Services for Oregon State University, and Mr. Paul Primack, who is the Director of our OUS International Programs. I want to start off just by saying that I think that listening to the testimony and listening to the comments of the committee, I believe we're having a heated agreement about the intent of this. Of these two bills, the bills we testified on earlier and the bill of this bill today here. We do appreciate, understand, and support the intent behind the bill. We are again concerned about some unintended consequences and we welcome the opportunity to work with the sponsors, with legislative counsel, if possible to maybe tighten up or even loosen up some language, if possible to just address the concerns that we will have and that our witnesses will take.
And we will welcome your good advice. Please.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Fowler, and I am here representing the Oregon University System. One of the things that we do on campus is that we go out and we purchase infrastructure, software, hardware from companies that we know as globalized companies. These are companies that have already globalized, that have service centers, engineering centers, both in the United States and worldwide. When we buy these products, we go out and we also purchase service contracts or warranty contracts to service those equipment so that when that product fails or it gets to a point that we don't have the background knowledge to effect a repair, then we call upon the services of that company to help us solve those problems. Depending upon the time of day, we may reach a service engineer or a technician anywhere within that company's structure. And it could be India, it could be London, it could be Australia, it could be Texas. It just depends upon the time of day. So as we read the bill, it indicates that we would have problems with a contract with that company because part of that service may be outsourced to another location in the world. We could say that maybe we could go find a third-party company that would provide service strictly within the borders of the United States. However, many of these companies have proprietary information that they don't release to third-party companies. And so if we relied on a third-party vendor for support and they could not answer our questions or provide a solution, then they would have to contact the primary vendor, which in the language that I read in the bill would make them a subcontractor of that third-party contractor, and which would violate then the language. So it's our concern that we'd be able to have these contracts to had the support to maintain the systems and provide the business continuity that we need within the university system. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify and welcome questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Paul Primack. I serve as the Director of International Programs for the university system, and we operate a number of exchange programs and global internships for students in the Oregon university system. And I'm here to raise some concerns, I think unintended concerns, about the bill, because we operate this global network of programs for students in order to better prepare them for a more globalized economy. We think there are significant benefits to these experiences that students have. We also think that the way that the bill is written currently, without providing exemptions for these kinds of services, would severely inhibit our ability to operate. I'm speaking on behalf also of AHA International, which is a academic program of the University of Oregon, and numerous other university programs. In order to provide support for our students abroad, we need to be able to contract with for services, for support, for language instruction, for housing, for numerous activities in support of our students. And we see this as a potential conflict.
Okay, fine.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Questions on the committee? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'm smiling because I had not thought about that last issue at all, and appreciate your raising it. My son participated in the Oregon State program at the University of Lyon in France for a year, and which he benefited greatly from. He now speaks fluent French and has some understanding of the French culture, which he would not have had he not attended that program, which was sponsored through the Oregon University system.
Thank you.
So I appreciate your pointing out this little wrinkle in our bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I think that we all would welcome your assistance in trying to improve on the language and make sure that we remove the unintended consequences from this bill. I'm going to ask this panel and our other witnesses, if you have suggestions for improving unintended consequences, if you'd please leave your contact information with our committee assistant, Mr. Kessinger, before you leave today. The intention would be to put together what I hope would be a very quick work group to iron these items out. So thank you so very, very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Next, I'd like to call Jim Woody from ODOT. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Whitty. I lead ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. I'm here today to, as well, provide you with observations in potentially unintended impacts of House Bill 2831 in its current form. Currently, ODOT is considering new revenue systems and traffic management systems for the Oregon transportation system that involve high levels of new technology. In order to explore these effective and appropriate solutions, ODOT benefits by employing consultants and contractors with worldwide experience and world-class expertise in cutting-edge contractors, cutting-edge applications of technology. The overwhelming bulk of firms the agency employs are based in the United States. Yet these United States firms do substantial business in other markets, Canada, Europe, Latin America, elsewhere. Because the traffic and road funding problems in other parts of the world are often more severe than here, sometimes these USA-based firms develop expertise by working on other geographic location problems that where the technical expertise is now located there, not here. and the personnel is located there as well. I have three examples that will kind of focus this for you. Recently, my office met with four representatives from IBM. They are a team that has particular expertise in developing innovative transportation financing systems, and they do not office together. One of them was from Oregon. He basically introduced the group to us. The second one was a Frenchman who happens to be working headquartered in New Jersey, an Indian from India headquartered in Washington, D.C., and the American was headquartered in the Netherlands. But they work as a team on problems, and we were exploring working together, partnering on some technological applications. We're both ODOT and IBM would put dollars into the project. We think that these provisions might discourage this kind of partnership because IBM couldn't put its top team on the effort. It would have to go with a second team or maybe no team. Maybe the deal wouldn't come together. A second example would be we do traffic and revenue work to explore the effects of alterations to the system on traffic flow for planning purposes. There are only three U.S.-based firms that do this work. There's more that do it, but that have highly regarded by the financial institutions, so there's the ones you want to use. And these firms typically work worldwide. Their expertise is diffused throughout the globe, and they have talent from multiple continents brought into a local project with little effort and minimal expense. I recall a conference call we had last year involving deployment of a sensitive traffic stop survey where the participants included people from the U.S., the United Kingdom, and Chile. Now, interestingly enough, without the Chilean participation, which involved critical on-point expertise that we couldn't find anyplace else, the survey may have suffered public relations difficulties and damaged data, which would then thwart the application of the computer analysis that we needed. That did not happen because we have the appropriate expertise, and the traffic stop survey proceeded without a hitch. Third example, we employ other consultants that U.S.-based consultants, but they have clients in other markets. And if the way the bill's written now, if the consultant went into Canada and spent a week there working on a project, they couldn't do any work for us while they were there. And that means it kind of hurts our timeline, and that could be a workflow disruption. So you're starting to get the point here. Technology is global, and it's you can pull somebody in with expertise from someplace else in the world on the phone or in on a computer email and solve your problem in short order, and it just makes sense to be able to do that. So I guess I don't need to go into the big summary here. I think you get my point.
Thank you very much, Jim. Some points well made. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that there probably are some possible unintended consequences in this bill that need to be ironed out. I would ask you, however, to point out to me in the bill where the person who went to Canada for a week would be a problem. This sounds to me like a person who his place of business is in the United States and he's visiting Canada. I want to see in the bill where that is a problem.
Well, I can answer that.
Good.
Representative Bernhardt. Line 4 on page 2.
Yeah.
That performs the work at a site outside the United States.
Yep. Okay.
If I happen to be in a hotel in Canada, and I'm a subcontractor, and I do some email from there that has to do with his work, I might be in violation of the law.
That's what I was looking for. Thank you.
He's quicker than I am.
Thank you. Additional questions or comments? Not seeing any. Jim, would you be willing to assist that work group as well?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate that very much. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I'd like to call up Jim Craven and Jack Eiselman, please.
Thank you. morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven representing, and I want to stress this first word of my association. It is the American Electronics Association, and we're talking here today about global economy and offshoring and outsourcing, but I do represent the American Electronics Association, the Oregon Council of that organization, so I just wanted to get that clear on the record. Listening to the previous testimony, I imagine we could probably fill a room with unintended consequences. There's a couple of representative samplings here for you today that you've heard of from state agencies, but we could probably fill the room up with people who are asking for exclusions or exemptions or a little bit of accommodation on this issue. Not sure who of you have been involved in the past in rewrites of the public contracting law, but it is an awful mountain to climb and is full of unintended consequences, any of you who touched those issues, and we've done a lot of work the last couple of sessions on that. I think obviously at the 10,000-foot level, there's nobody in this room that disagrees that we ought to do everything possible to grow jobs in Oregon, to grow jobs in the United States. Certainly, we don't disagree with that, and I don't think there's anybody in this room that does or in this building. We may differ on approach to the best way to accomplish that common shared goal. We do disagree, I think, fundamentally, that the best way to address this issue is to try to put the genie of international global competition back into the bottle, to ignore, in Tom Friedman's words, the growing flatness of the world. To be in business today, particularly in the high-tech business, but increasingly in all forms, whether you're in manufacturing or agriculture or timber or paper or anything else, means that you are playing on a global scale. And that's in the high-tech business, you're almost global from day one or you're not going to exist. But it used to be indicative of us more than other people, and now everybody's catching up. And so it is, you know, almost everybody is somehow engaged in the global economy. There's two issues in 2831. One tries to get at direct contracting procurement types of issues and saying that work has to be performed only in the United States for the life of the contract. And that's what people have hit on so far. But there's another section of the bill that uses this new phrase in law called development assistance. And it's a little hard to work through that part of the bill. But this is, those of you who have been on revenue and talked about the phrase tax expenditures, the way I read the bill, it says if you're a firm in Oregon that receives any one of the 362 tax expenditures in that thick book, somehow you can't do any work outside the United States. And that's a really thorny part of this bill that we haven't addressed yet today, and Representative Barnhart is nodding his head.
And smiling.
Yeah, and smiling, for the record. I think that hits at companies engaged in work even that are not engaged in formal contracting with the state of Oregon. So it's a little tough to parse, but it is a big, I want to point that part of the bill out, because somebody who gets a child care tax credit from the state of Oregon would not be able to do any work offshore the way I read it. So maybe it's a drafting error. We think there's a fundamental different approach to this common challenge of the big challenge of global competitiveness. And let me tell you a little bit about what AEA is doing. We are a national trade association, and you have a copy of a report we did 2 years ago. We have a brand new version coming out any day now, and I couldn't get it for today's hearing. 2 years ago, we published this report called Losing the Competitive Advantage, the Challenge for Science and Technology in the United States. Sometimes it takes a while for things to catch hold, but that report is now gaining serious traction in Washington, D.C. The other piece I handed you out to you is the Speaker Pelosi's Innovation Agenda, which was just released a week or two ago. We have worked very closely with the new Speaker of the House in Washington, D.C. In fact, there are a lot of common themes between these two reports that you see, and that it's not an accident. Our AEA staff and Speaker Pelosi's staff are working daily on trying to focus the nation's mind on the real challenge that lies before us, which is in an increasingly global competitive world, we need to compete. The issue is not increasingly just a race to the bottom. It's a race to the top. And those who believe that companies do work offshore solely to chase cheap labor are missing really the big picture that's going on. And when the session's over, if you haven't yet read Tom Friedman's book, it's fascinating reading. It's about 700 pages, and I doubt you'll get it done in the next few months. I finally got my way through it last month, and I had thought it was a sort of a panacea of, well, things are going global, so live with it. And that's really not the point in Friedman's book. The point is people around this world are getting smarter and competing and want to eat our lunch at the highest levels. And if we don't get serious in this country with the seriousness of the Sputnik days to increase our education, to increase our basic research, and to take these threats seriously, then people will eat our lunch, and we will lose our competitiveness. I don't know that this approach of a small state like Oregon trying to put that genie back in the bottle is fundamentally the best way. Certainly well-intentioned, obviously fraught with unintended consequences in the whole public contracting realm. Here in Oregon, what we are working on with you, we are 10 years into a program to increase science and technology programs at our state universities. We in the private sector have put $100 million into that effort in the last 10 years here in Oregon, matching about $50 million that you have spent from public funds. So we are trying to get serious. We've almost increased the graduation rates of engineers and computer science and other technology degrees in Oregon by almost 50% in 10 years, while the national trend is going the other direction. So it's something you ought to be proud of, because it's really been your partnership with the private sector to make that happen. There's other things that you've heard early in your overviews. Manufacturing 21 initiative, the Oregon Innovation Council has a set of proposals before this body this session. All of those are the kinds of things that represent getting serious about growing our state and U.S. competitiveness. One other point I just want to make, we talk a lot about outsourcing, but we sometimes forget insourcing. And we sometimes forget that Oregon is the home to tens of thousands of jobs whose headquarters is a foreign country. Such companies as Wacker, such companies as Hynix, such companies just announced Solar World in Hillsboro, going to bring 1,000 jobs to this state. I'm wondering what the unintended consequence would be if the national government of Germany had such a law that said you couldn't get a tax expenditure in Germany if you were going to go build jobs in Hillsboro, Oregon. So it's just some things I encourage you to think about that we open up a big debate here. I think rather than try to raise barriers and send mixed messages to our global companies who are investing in Oregon and bringing thousands of family wage jobs today to Oregon, we should rather focus on improving our educational system, growing jobs we have here, working with companies who want to invest in Oregon and help make them successful. Just on a very small niche, in the Oregon public contracting law, there is a provision that says when the state of Oregon is letting a bid, and it's ORS 279A.120, there is a preference currently in Oregon state law for Oregon bidders for goods and services. And it's basically an all other things being equal kind of test. In other words, and to quote the law, if price, fitness, availability, and quality are otherwise equal. So we do try to get at the issue in that small way by saying that when companies bid on Oregon work and an Oregon company bids and you as protectors of the taxpayer dollars get the functionality you want at a good price, we tip the scales to an Oregon company. And we think that's appropriate. I just wanted to bring that to your attention, that we've addressed this in a small way. The global way is a bigger question, but we do try in our public contracting law to tip the scales where we can to Oregon bidding companies. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to share some thoughts with you today.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eisenman.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Isselman of Tonkin Torp. I appear today on behalf of the Software Association of Oregon and its 600 member companies and technology professionals. Like many of the witnesses before you here today and the members of the committee, we're in vehement agreement with you on many of the key drivers of this bill, not the least of which is that Oregon frequently loses jobs and income to out-of-state and international competitors. And we want to do what we can to make sure that doesn't happen. And like you, as members of the committee have expressed, the Software Association of Oregon wants to push the envelope in order to do that. And we may disagree on the best approach on how to do that, but one approach that we are going to champion before this committee as we go forward in session is that we really need to take a look at updating and adapting our development incentives. We have a bill that we've worked with several members to develop, House Bill 2779, that ties economic development assistance directly to job creation by creating a payroll tax credit. We think this is an important incentive for two very basic reasons. The first, it provides development assistance to employers like SAO members who rely on people, who don't have an overarching dependence on real property or capital equipment. Their real need is people. And today there does not exist an incentive on the books that is uniquely helpful when your main asset is people. Secondly, and to the heart of the matter addressed in this bill, the development assistance is only available so long as the jobs are created and remain in Oregon. If the jobs are moved out of state or if they're not created here, whether that's Idaho or Indonesia, no benefit can be claimed. And we think that's an important step in how we approach economic development in the state. I've shared with you an article that was published last month in the Portland Business Journal, both about our tax credit and one we've modeled our bill after, which is up in British Columbia. They adopted a 35% payroll-based tax credit and are experiencing really a burgeoning software industry in Western Canada as a result of that measure. We would encourage this committee and this assembly to take a look at our incentives, update them, and adapt them in a way that ties development assistance to job creation and make sure the development assistance sticks to the jobs. We think that's what's critically important here. And we recognize that some of the incentives on the books right now are given, and there's not sufficient stickiness to the jobs. And we would look forward to working with this committee and others in the assembly and collaborating and looking at new ways to approach development assistance. Also, again, on economic development, we have a concern, and this is another probably unintended consequence of the bill, that the manner in which the bill is drafted may well be incompatible with the stated industry development goals of the state. If you go to Chapter 285, this assembly has instructed the state to focus industry development activities on traded sector industries. And we have a concern that it would be quite difficult to find employers who meet the criteria on the books for development assistance and would meet the further criteria of this bill that they do none of the work covered by the development assistance outside the United States. And an example is a sales organization where you're going to add a corporate headquarters here, you're going to have a sales force here, but of course you have sales representatives overseas close to your customers. That situation could preempt development assistance, and again, we think that's an unintended consequence of the bill and probably incompatible with the stated industrial development policy of the state. So, in summary, we agree with you. Let's keep Oregon jobs in Oregon. Let's grow Oregon jobs here. And we think the best way to approach this issue is to reevaluate the type and manner of development assistance delivered by the state, and we'll demonstrate this commitment to you by working with your committee and your colleagues to produce legislative measures that achieve that goal. Thanks very much. I'm open to your questions.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for your testimony. You heard me say earlier that I think we should push the envelope. I still believe we should. As you both know, I've been an advocate on both sides of the tax expenditure issue. I believe that we should create tax expenditures where they help the state, and I think we should get rid of the ones that don't help the state. And I believe that the one that Mr. Isselman is discussing is probably a good one. I'll have to look at it very closely. I was pushed and helped to get many research and development type expenditures on the books, but I want to get rid of the ones that don't work. And in the same way, this bill, I believe there are some unintended consequences we need to iron out, but I believe that we really need to be a leader in attempting to stop the flow of jobs from the state and from the country. And I look forward to both of you helping us do that.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Jim, your point about avoiding isolationism is very well taken, and I agree with it completely. I do, however, as the kid whose grandmother took him up to the top of the hill to watch Sputnik go over, I think one could also make an argument that Sputnik in and of itself was largely responsible for one of the biggest scientific, one of the largest research and certainly economic development efforts domestically that we have ever experienced as a nation. And with that, I appreciate your comments very, very much. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lastly, I'd like to call up Duke Shepherd, please.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I always testify last, so I don't know if I add much value at this point, but I'll go with what I've got. First, let me start out in trying to get ready for this hearing. There are not comprehensive, consistent, reliable, or verifiable numbers on the actual job losses to outsourcing in this country. There are a lot of estimates. There's a reason that the statistics you hear cited all come from consulting firms. There isn't a place you can point and click the Bureau of Labor Statistics and say, we created this many jobs this month, and we lost this many jobs this month, and here's how many are precisely due to outsourcing. Now, that may not be surprising since so much of this is driven by federal policy. But we believe the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition's numbers seem very well researched, and based on our experience with workers, I think most numbers that you hear from consulting firms are understated. And that's just from the folks who feel the effects. The pieces of the bill that I came here to testify on really are the ones that Jim Craven raised, and I must admit I did not go through and consider the 362 tax expenditures portion of it. I focused really on what I viewed as the intent of the bill, on the development assistance. And looking at it as with every government incentive for economic development assistance, it's finite. Whether it's cash or credit or better interest rates or tax abatements, there's a limited amount. There are only so many to be used. And for every deal done, that means there's another investment that couldn't be made. Whether that's money that could have been used somewhere else for education, for scholarships, or for infrastructure, or it means other businesses didn't get that crack at that assistance. So the real issue here is whether we're maximizing the value for the state investment. Do we just look at a short-term score chart where we say, hey, some jobs were created, the business is here, deal's done, that's good? Or do we ask, do these public investments ultimately grow the economy? Does a public investment in short-term jobs that are then shipped overseas represent the highest and best use of limited public dollars and programs? Do we want to rent jobs or build the economy? Do we want to subsidize cycles of hiring, layoff, and retraining for lower-wage jobs over and over and over? Government incentives actually affect a relatively limited set of businesses and a relatively small set of firms when you look at the entire size of the economy. Most businesses start, grow, make their investments, and their location expansion decisions without government involvement and without government incentives. So if the resources are limited, The best use of those dollars are the ones that result in jobs here in Oregon, up and down the value chain, jobs that spawn and spin off other Oregon jobs. If you believe outsourcing is good or bad, inevitable or preventable, we believe there's no way to justify subsidizing it with public dollars. We should use resources to maximize value for communities, and we should create an environment in which long-term investment in Oregon is rewarded and provided with the appropriate incentives. We think this bill is a bold, important, and overdue step in that direction. It's great to hear people ready to push the envelope on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Duke? Not seeing any. Thank you so very much. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on House Bill 2831 today? I'm not seeing any. Just a final reminder, anyone that wishes to help clean up some of the language in this bill, please leave your information with Barry. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 20, public testimony on House Bill 2831. Ellen, could you give us a brief rundown on our Monday agenda?
Yes, thank you, Chair Witt. Members of the committee, on March 12th, Monday, at 8 a.m. in Hearing Room C, we'll be hearing House Bill 2246, a public hearing and a work session on that bill, which requires the Department of Human Services to transfer the Jobs Plus Participants Oregon Jobs Individual Education Account to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And we'll also be hearing 2599 with its first public hearing, and that bill limits television advertising by the Oregon State Lottery, limits it to the promotion of new games.
Thank you very much. Any other business to come before our committee today? Not seeing or hearing any. We are adjourned. Thank you all very, very much.
Thanks.